Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. As we have noted often in the past, one front in that war, of course, is the home front. And at the moment, considerable agitation is taking place about what to do about securing the home front, whether we should at all, with respect specifically to a border wall, as Donald Trump promised he would build in the course of the 2016 election. I'm very pleased to say we have with us today a woman who has supported Donald Trump, has worked as a surrogate in his campaign, who founded America First Latinos as an element of the effort to bring to the White House a man who promised to build the wall and to address the problems of specifically immigration and the challenges that it poses illegally, especially to the security and well-being of Americans, a project that she has specifically devoted her time to as the co-founder and director of the Remembrance Project. This is a non-profit organization dedicated to honoring and remembering Americans who have been killed by illegal aliens. Her name is Maria Espinoza, and we've spoken with her in the past and are delighted to do so. On the day after President Trump sat down with congressional leaders and made it sound as though another amnesty may be in the works and perhaps no wall. Maria, welcome. It's so good to have you. I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us. Welcome back.
Hello, Frank. Thank you so much for having me on, and Happy New Year.
Thank you, and a Happy New Year to you. I hope it will be. Let me ask you about this meeting yesterday at the White House, Maria. I don't know if you had a chance to watch the 55 minutes or so that were broadcast, but what did you make of it, and where do you think we go from here?
Well, I think it's a good thing for President Trump to bring both sides together. You know, and really he has no choice at this point because he's really backed into a corner, Frank. You know, because of our GOP leadership, you know, siding with and taking up the Democratic platform, here we are. Trump is forced to sort of make an art of the deal to get this country out of the situation that the former administration and both parties have placed us in.
So I do want to talk about the Remembrance Project and the work you're doing with it, but just staying with this for a moment, it seems as though the art of the deal is shaping up to be that the president is prepared to accept whatever the Congress can fashion in the way of a compromise, which would seem to mean that since there is a sizable number of advocates on both sides of the aisle for not only DACA and some sort of amnesty for this so-called deferred action on childhood arrivals, but, you know, perhaps more broadly, an amnesty for their extended families. This would seem to fly in the face of the kinds of promises that the president made during the campaign. How would you and others who supported him, in part for his approach, very much in contrast to all of that, that would seem to be over the side?
Well, I think right now, Frank, that what we all have to do, and your listeners, is to help President Trump keep his campaign promises. He does have an America First agenda, and we have to stress that as well as his 70-point immigration policy that he put out a few months ago. So, you know, I'm giving up on President Trump. I am very disappointed, however, in some of our own elected officials who allowed this situation to take place. They should have fought this when Obama was in office and when this DACA situation and DAPA came up. And now we have that U.S. Judge Alsup, you know, trying to stop President Trump from rescinding an unconstitutional action. I'm not a lawyer, but it just seems that if the executive branch implemented this unconstitutional action, it would think that the executive branch could rescind it.
Yeah, well, you would. And in fact, this is just, of course, the latest example of judicial overreach, with federal judges all over the country telling the president, despite his clear authorities on immigration issues, on, oh, I don't know, transgenders in the military or the military more generally, and now on this DACA business, what he can and can't do, when it seems as though it's really not within their purview constitutionally. Let me ask you, Maria, and I appreciate your wanting the president to succeed in the ways that he promised to do. What, as you see it from the perspective of the Remembrance Project, are the stakes? Should we wind up with more illegal aliens coming here? And I understand they are coming here after things abating dramatically during much of the first year, presumably because of the president's stated policies. The signal that there will now be an amnesty seems to be opening the floodgates again. What do you think are the prospects that we will see more Americans killed, more Americans who will have to be remembered by your project if this plays out as some on Capitol Hill seem to intend?
You're absolutely right. There will be more Stolen Lives Quilt banners having to memorialize Americans who've been killed by people who shouldn't have been here in the first place. And that's why the Remembrance Project was created in 2009 by myself and my husband, Tim Ling. So there will be more people who will be killed in the future. And here there is nothing done about this issue. And the urgency that Paul Ryan, or it was actually Dick Durbin, mentioned, there's an urgency and these lives are hanging in the balance. Well, what about the lives of innocent American children who have been killed and should still be here with their families, enjoying their American dream? You know, no one in that room that I heard mention the Angel Moms and Dads and Stolen Lives families. And that is the most egregious element of illegal immigration. And this has to stop. That's the urgency here, is to stop the killing of innocent Americans.
You would think that would be the first order of business for people who have a duty to the American people, to represent them in Congress as well as in the White House. Maria, give us a sense of the magnitude of the loss of life that we've seen that you are honoring with your Remembrance Project.
Well, you know, unfortunately, the American people are not privy to that. And when my husband and I met with Attorney General Jeff Sessions several months ago on this issue, and we thought that we would be able to get the statistics, but Attorney General Sessions says, no, it's impossible for them to obtain because the municipalities do not cooperate with them. Sanctuary cities, and and there are families that I speak with, because we are very grassroots, Frank, so we know the integral parts of some of these cases, and there is so much wrong with what is taking place in our court systems and re-victimizing Americans, and you don't know about it because it's not out there. The courts try to stifle their voice, of course, if it hasn't gone to trial, but you have DAs and judges, as you see this Judge Alsup, basically putting forth their personal liberal agendas over the law. And this is the mess that we're in. However, I think with these elected officials, we have to hold them account. We have to vote them out. And, there are 34 GOP representatives who signed a letter asking Paul Ryan to give amnesty to the DACA recipients. And again, I think all of this falls on the shoulders of our GOP leadership. They're directly to blame for all this and for not placing the betterment of and the health and welfare of Americans first.
We have to leave it at that, Maria Espinoza. I appreciate so much what you're doing with the Remembrance Project. We're delighted you now have a beachhead here in the swamp in Washington, D.C., and look forward to hearing more about your efforts and certainly commend what you're trying to do to make sure there aren't more of us killed and therefore in need of remembrance at the hands of these illegal aliens. I hope you'll keep up the good work. How can people find out more about your work, the Remembrance Project, Maria?
They can email me at director@theremembrance.org. therememberanceproject.org and go to our website, www.therememberanceproject.org. And they'll have to type that as it is in the URL bar because major search engines have suppressed the search bar of our website.
Well, this is a subject we'll be turning to later in the program. The suppression of freedom of speech is a serious problem. I'm so sorry it's afflicting you as well as others of us. Keep up the good work, my friend. Come back to us again soon. Next up, Diana West joins us for our weekly visit with us. We'll get her take on this DACA business and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It is a pleasure to have with us every single week, but especially this one. Diana West, a longtime syndicated columnist, these days doing splendid work on her blog, dianawest.net, the Daily Caller, and elsewhere. She is, of course, the author of two wonderful books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal, and one of the most thoughtful and engaging intellects of our time, as far as I'm concerned. So it's always a delight to be able to see what's on her mind at the moment. And I have the feeling that the dodgy dossier is one of the things that are on your mind. Diana West, welcome back. It's good to have you. Is that so?
Yes, thank you. Yes, I think that is correct. It's a all-absorbing prospect as we look at the threads and pieces of evidence and Sturm und Drang around this entire exercise that is encapsulated by dodgy dossier.
And you know, we're about a year on into this thing, as the Washington Times points out today, from the moment when it was first published by BuzzFeed. Remind us what we know about it. First of all, we better just make sure everybody understands what we're talking about. This document produced by a British spy for a group called Fusion GPS, apparently paid for by Hillary Clinton. Have I got all that right?
Yes, to date, yes.
This document has become the source of much thrashing and perhaps some, if not actually illicit activity, some very troubling politicization of federal agencies like the Federal Bureau of Investigations, the FBI. Give us a read on what you think we do know at this point and its implications.
Well, what we do know is that this activity that produced the dossier was paid for by the Democratic National Committee and the Hillary Clinton campaign through their law firm Perkins Coe. So we're looking at, yes, opposition research, political information to be used in a partisan fashion in the heat of a campaign. So when we take that information and see it used by the government, by the Department of Justice, by the FBI, in a fashion that has absolutely nothing to do with the normal course of politics, we are looking at politicization of our agencies. We are looking at what amounts to, as far as I can tell, a conspiracy by factions inside the government to aid the election of Hillary Clinton. So this becomes a very serious matter because this is everything wrong with the abuse of power. What we're potentially looking at is the beginnings of a coup. We're looking at the beginnings of a machinations and operation that is completely outside the normal channels of above board, normal, expected political activity in the heat of a campaign. And what continues to strike me, and I think we've talked about this, but I think it's a subject to pursue, is what drove these people, these various officials, to risk all, because what we're learning about their activities does indeed risk all. We've already seen demotions, retirements, and so on of some of the principals involved in this to date. What drove them? Because in Washington, we're used to seeing politicians come in and out of office, parties changing their own power, you know, going to K Street, then coming back to the Hill, you know, and so on. We're used to the revolving door, even if we don't like it. It's certainly a way of life, and it is normal politics as usual. what drove these people to risk all? And I don't think it was just Hillary Clinton. I do think there's an ideological component here and perhaps a larger dimension that we're not able to really comprehend yet. So this is kind of the larger picture I'm trying to sketch in or at least sense. So there's that on the one hand. And then we're looking at on the Hill, we're looking at the congressmen and senators who are still very focused on this despite all the scandal, all the distractions, all the other kinds of activity as we start the new year. So it's a big moment, and we're starting to see new kind of new strategies, new weaponry in terms of information being brought out and so on as we go forward.
Well, let me ask you about one other piece of this, Dinah West, and that is that in addition to all that you've said, what has become more and more apparent with the passage of time is this wasn't simply an effort on the part of, the deep state, it's been called, or elements thereof, to influence the election. It was also intended and operated to try to undermine the elected president of the United States after the balloting was ended. And that's the thing that really makes this more, I think, aptly described as a coup than anything else. And Diana, I just wonder, have you had a chance to look at the transcripts of the testimony that was provided by the Fusion GPS founder Glenn Simpson that was, I think, rather unbelievably released unilaterally by Dianne Feinstein yesterday? And how does that inform your thinking on this at the moment?
Yes, I'm still going through it. I find it quite fascinating. I'm not sure what Senator Feinstein hoped to gain through this release. It doesn't seem to help the Democrat story as far as I've seen already. We've already seen talk that the FBI, coming out of this dossier that Glenn Simpson discussed, that the FBI told him or told his contractor, Christopher Steele, the MI6 retired Russian agent with purview over Russia, that the FBI had a source inside the Trump camp, which begs all kinds of questions, including why was the FBI telling Christopher Steele of GPS Fusion this kind of information. But then we see later on in just the very same news cycle, we see a reporter who has sources close to Fusion GPS saying there was no such source. So there's a lot of confusion there. I was quite struck looking into the very fascinating nexus that a woman named Nellie Orr provides. She was a Fusion GPS Russia expert that we learned about last month, who worked on Russia, was hired as a Russian academic expert for Fusion after this whole project was stood up back in the spring of 2016. She's the one who also took out the ham radio operator's license, which I think is such an interesting detail. She's fluent in Russian. And when Glenn Simpson was asked whether anyone besides Christopher Steele was working in this area, he immediately pushed the argument into, you mean in Russia? Do I have any contractors in Russia? And he essentially said no and mentioned a translator he has on staff. He did not mention Nellie Orr, who seems to be a very important person in this because she is married to a Justice Department official named Bruce Orr, who was also in December when it came out, demoted from a very senior ranking position inside Justice because he had been holding secret meetings with Christopher Steele and with Glenn Simpson, unbeknownst to the Justice Department, who also was never told that his wife, Nellie Orr, was working for Fusion GPS.
The plot twists of this thing would make for a great movie, and I'm sure there will be one made in due course. But it is kind of mind-boggling the degree to which there has been this, conspiracy. I don't know what else to describe it that was going on inside senior reaches of the government, the Justice Department, the FBI, probably the National Security Council, the UN ambassador's office in the mission there, the White House Oval Office, it would seem as well. We are not much closer to getting to the bottom of it, and I look forward to having a chance after you and I and others have had an opportunity to really review with care what this transcript reveals. But The plot thickens, suffice it to say, Diana West, and I'm very pleased to be able to discuss it with you and look forward to your writings on it at dianawest.net. Check it out, folks. Diana, thank you so much for your time today. As always, we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Keep up the good work, my dear, and we'll be back to you shortly.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Dr. Zeev Magan joins us, I believe, for the first time on this program, and I'm very pleased to have him with us. He is the former chair of the Department of Middle Eastern History at Bar-Ilan University. He has a similar role today at the Shalem College in Jerusalem. He is also a research associate at the Begin Sadat Center for Strategic Studies and an author many times over, including a important book about the virtues of the flesh, passion, and purity in early Islamic jurisprudence, and a new book shortly to be with us entitled The Mind of the Ayatollahs. He has a PhD from Columbia University, has served in the Israeli Defense Forces, and we are delighted to have him with us to talk a bit about things happening in the neighborhood over there. We catch up with him, I believe, in Israel. Professor Magan, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk to us.
My pleasure.
Well, let's start with the mind of the Ayatollahs, if we could. You're a serious student of Iran. I'm wondering what you think is going on in their minds at the moment. Are they panicking? Do they anticipate that this is the beginning of the end for the mullahocracy, or is this just another bump in the road to the realization of their grand designs to destroy, well, among other things, the little Satan, your country, and mine, the great Satan?
Well, that's a very interesting question. The Ayatollahs, of course, are Shiite Muslims, and Shiite Muslims have a double mentality going, which involves, on the one hand, a feeling of superiority in the Muslim world. They see themselves, despite their minority status, the Shiites are about 10% of the Muslims, and Sunnis are 90% of the Muslims. Nevertheless, Shiites see themselves as the elite. They see themselves as the true Muslims and as the proper leaders of the Muslim world. And that's been something they've been trying to establish themselves as since the revolution in Iran in 1979. On the other hand, Shiites are scared to death. They have been scared to death for 1,400 years. They're a tiny, persecuted, hated minority. And there's been a boomerang effect since their revolution of Sunni extremist Muslim groups sprouting up all over the place and directing their daggers at Iran. So it's not so much the current protests that are scaring them. All the current unrest has fearsome implications for the Ayatollahs, but perhaps not to the same extent as what has always frightened Shiites, and that is that they're a persecuted, hated minority, and they could be wiped out of existence at any time. So, you know, it's this double thing going.
Let me ask you about, even within their own country, there are very substantial numbers of non-Shiites, the Yazidis, the Baluchis, the Kurds among them. Do you anticipate that this is a source of particular concern to the Ayatollahs of the Shiite tradition? And is it a potential fault line that we should be exploiting in the West?
Well, there's no question that the Sunnis in Iran have been, when they are activists, and some of them are activists, they have made some trouble for the regime. The current unrest, on the other hand, is not about Sunnism or about Shiism. It's much more about anti-Islamic Iranian nationalism, kind of harking back both to the Pahlavi Shahs, the kings of the 20th century who tried to westernize, modernize, and de-Islamize Iran, and also all the way back to the pre-Islamic Sasanian and Achaemenid, you know, Cyrus and all those guys. That's scary to the Ayatollahs on a different level, because that's not just the Sunni-Shi'i schism. That's a statement against religion entirely. and it's, you know, in favor of nationalism instead.
And we're seeing some sentiment along these lines, of course, in the protests in the street at the moment. Professor, there's so much more to talk about Iran, and perhaps we can come back to you soon about that as this story continues to develop. But I did want to ask you in the remainder of our time with you about Israel and some rather important changes, it would appear, in American policy, not only from Barack Obama to Donald Trump with respect to U.S. relations with the Jewish state, but more to the point, U.S. policy towards the Palestinians. It's been rather breathtaking from my perspective, and I'd like to get your sense of it when you look at Donald Trump's reaction to the Palestinians and others criticizing him and voting against him in the United Nations when he recognized the reality of Israel's capital being Jerusalem and moved our embassy there. And, you know, the possibilities of cutting off the Palestinians from U.S. financial support and UNRWA, this U.N. relief agency as well. And even the U.S. ambassador, David Friedman, tweeting just today, I think, that, you know, the problem with peace that is eluding the Jews and the Palestinians is the Palestinians support terrorism against the Jews. Talk about whether this really represents kind of a tectonic shift towards what my friend Daniel Pipes has called the Israel victory strategy, perhaps. A very different approach than what we've seen out of U.S. administrations, Republican and Democratic, in the past.
Again, speaking not as an expert, but as an Israeli citizen, and looking across the Atlantic, I can say that Donald Trump is sui generis. He is unique in the history of U.S. and world politics. I like him a lot for that reason, although many others do not. He's a guy who says what's on his mind, and he cuts through a lot of the bull and gets to the heart of the matter. And he isn't easily swayed by all those who say you can't do this and you can't do that, and this is against our, you know, State Department tradition, and this is against diplomatic norms, and et cetera. He goes right to the heart of the matter, and certainly as an Israeli, I can appreciate where he's gone with this. And I think Daniel Pipes is right that in Israel, we're not just following Trump here, but there is a Trump effect that Israelis are tired of constantly suggesting compromises to the other side and having them not only not be accepted, but having them answered by, you know, massacre and murder, and instead come out and say, you know what, this is our land, and we've earned it, and you know, we have no desire to displace anybody or hurt anyone else, but we're going to defend our land. And I think, yeah, that is a shift. There's no question about it. I see the shift here in Israel. There's a lot less apologizing going on than there was in recent years.
I appreciate your modesty on the subject, but you pass for an expert for the moment with us. Do you think that this actually conduces to a difference in this so-called peace process? Or does it simply conduce to a heightened likelihood of peace simply because, with or without a process, there will be a new recognition of the reality that Israel does, in fact, control the territory and by right should, given its military victories?
I don't know about the by right should part. I don't think we're ever going to convince the other side of that. But I think you're right. I think that anyone who kind of dabbles in game theory or looks back at history can figure out that, for instance, when the Muslims signed treaties that were long-lasting with other powers like the Austro-Hungarian Empire or any other element in the medieval or modern West, it was always because those countries put up a wall, an impregnable kind of iron wall that the Muslims finally had to stop charging ahead and engaging in jihad. And when they saw that they could not prevail, they signed treaties. It's actually something that goes way back to the Prophet Muhammad. He did the same thing when he saw he couldn't prevail. I think it's a natural human thing to do, but it's certainly attested in Muslim history. And I think that, you know, one of our great Zionist theoreticians and pioneers, a fellow by the name of Ze'ev Jabotinsky, his prescription was an iron wall. If you want peace, an iron wall will lead to peace.
a fascinating point at a very moment where we're talking about a wall here in this country as well, as you know. We have to leave it at that for the moment. I'm sorry to say thank you so much for joining us and for the work you're doing at the Shalom College in Jerusalem. We look forward with great anticipation to your new book, The Mind of the Ayatollahs, and hope you'll join us again in the near future. Next up, we'll speak with Christine Douglas-Williams about Canada and what is likely to happen there and here with freedom of speech and more. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined by the fabulous Christine Douglas-Williams. She is the author of a splendid book, Challenge of Modernizing Islam. She writes regularly for Jihad Watch and has recently published at the Gatestone Institute. She has been an outside advisor to Canada's Office of Religious Freedom, now of blessed memory, I'm afraid. And her experiences as well with the Canadian Race Relations Foundation is the subject of quite a bit of concern on both sides of the border because of what it suggests about freedom of speech imperiled in Canada and perhaps beyond if the people perpetrating it there of the red-green axis stripe, as I call them, have their way in this country as well. Christine Douglas-Williams, it's good to have you back. Happy New Year to you. Welcome.
Happy New Year to you, Frank. It's a privilege and a pleasure to come back.
Well, we hope that it will be happy, but at least it's a happy thing to be able to visit with you a little bit, though the subject that brings us together most immediately is not so happy. Tell us what happened with respect to your role at the Canadian Race Relations Foundation.
First of all, Frank, I'll start very briefly by saying what the Canadian Race Relations Foundation is. It's supposed to be an arm's length organization from the federal government. It's out of the Department of Heritage. And I was a director of the Canadian Race Relations Foundation until up to quite recently. I was given a warning about my writings on Jihad Watch and some of the comments I made specifically in the media. In fact, Melanie Joly, who is the Minister of Heritage, actually wrote me, quote, "I've become aware of language used in your online articles and blogs that appear to be, quote, inappropriate and inconsistent with the Canadian Race Relations Foundation mandate vision of promoting diversity and inclusion and respect for democracy." She outlined specific articles that I had written, and one was about my personal warning to Icelanders, where I highlighted the strategies, the smooth stealth strategies of the Muslim Brotherhood and their practice of deception. Another one was about M103, an anti-Islamophobia motion that passed in Canadian Parliament. And this was an article where I talked about the background, I warned about the players involved and their connection to the Muslim Brotherhood. And another article that she cited was one that I'd written for Jihad Watch. I was challenged, why write about jihadists and Muslim migrant crimes? Those were the three articles that she highlighted. Now, fast forward this to a comment that came out in the Toronto Star about my chair of the Canadian Race Relations Foundation. He spoke specifically about my role and how much I had contributed to that organization. For the record, I was the chair of the Investment Committee, on the Executive Committee, the Human Resource Committee, the Nominations Committee, and I have contributed hours on end to that organization, much of it pro bono. I was respected in that organization, given great reviews, but somehow it ended up being a disconnect between my job performance, my advocacy for human rights in the name of that organization, and my outside work about jihad and political Islam, which I see as very consistent with the work that I do in my activism when it comes to human rights.
It's a fascinating saga here and very troubling indeed that at the end of the day, it seems as though it's not so much about promoting diversity and inclusion as it is about suppressing speech that is not favored by the Trudeau government or, for that matter, others in the Islamophobia victimhood industry and their allies on the left. And I wanted just to tease this out with you a bit because a colleague of ours, former Congressman now Ambassador Pete Hoekstra, assigned recently to represent the United States in the Netherlands, was attacked viciously by CNN, their so-called K-File investigative unit, discredited fake news operation, if ever there was one, in part for appearing on this program and talking, as you have, Christine Douglas Williams, quite honestly, accurately, and I think appropriately about this phenomenon of Sharia supremacism and what it's doing to countries, notably yours, the Netherlands, other places in Europe, and for that matter here. As you look at this as an award-winning journalist and video producer and author, what's on the line, Christine, on both sides of the border, as you see it?
What's going on here is that there is a concerted effort, and I have been following this. It's starting at the highest levels. We're looking at the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. And when one looks at that motion I mentioned, Motion M103, which is an anti-Islamophobia motion, it was actually created on the groundwork of a petition called E411. If one read that petition, you would see clearly that it was very closely aligned. If a page, I would go so far as to say a page out of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, Islamophobia Observatory. And this is what provided the groundwork for that particular state admission of M103 that talks about promoting diversity and inclusion all across Canada. But it specifically mentions the word Islamophobia. And when there were efforts to say, let's not use the word Islamophobia because it's loaded, even from the mildest groups in Canada, it was sternly resisted that anti-Muslim bigotry must not be used. Islamophobia must be used because Islamophobia consists of insulting Islam as well. It's related to blasphemy laws, and it is in the observatory where it's described twofold. One is insulting Muslims, insulting Islam, because it's regarded as deeply offensive to Muslims. Therefore, it is a form of anti-Muslim bigotry. That is simply not so in Western culture. We pride ourselves. We actually define ourselves on freedom of speech. We have the right to offend, not the right to cross the lines into hate speech, but we certainly have the right to offend, and we certainly have the right to discuss. Every ideology out there, every ideology out there is open to scrutiny, except Islam. And this is what we see happening in North America. It is with it is consistent with the Muslim Brotherhood plan for North America to infiltrate society, to sabotage its miserable house from within by saying, look, we are a supremacist organization, which is what Islamism is about, and we intend to erode your free speech, thus putting ourselves above every other creed. And in fact, what they've effectively done is branded as racism. So they have essentially overtaken the entire racism industry and made it all about Islamophobia.
Yeah. You know, this point about free speech is so central because, as you know so well, it wouldn't end there. That's just a critical stepping stone to achieving our submission more generally. And I think there couldn't be more explicit about that as their objective. Christine, I did want to quickly ask you about this group Care Can that is actively promoting at the moment a National Day of Remembrance and Action on Islamophobia, and what that's about and what the government is likely to do with respect to this demand, and should they embrace it, what that might portend as well.
We have a pattern in Canada where there is a concerted effort to shut down free speech, to shut down criticism of Islam. In Care Can, now renamed, but it's the same organization declared by them, the National Council of Canadian Muslims, they have been behind this all Islamophobia drives in Canada, including charters in six Canadian cities and including an Islamophobia snitch line. When the mosque shootings happened last year in Quebec, one fellow was charged with six counts of murder. Prime Minister Trudeau actually said at that time that he called it terrorism, but terrorism charges were never laid, just straight first-degree murder charges. It was clearly hush-hush. The media actually wrote. There was nothing that came from this. Nobody ever established a motive, and stemming from that, the NCCM, which is Care Can, now comes about and says, how about we establish a national remembrance day due to these shootings that happened in the mosque, as well as a day of action against Islamophobia. This was a letter that went into the Prime Minister's office, and so far we have not heard any outcomes, but there are groups right there in Quebec that are opposing this drive because they're saying it goes right along with M103, and it is an attempt to shut down free speech in Canada because Canada is basically being hijacked now by these pro Islamist organizations of the Muslim Brotherhood.
I'm so glad that you are keeping your eye on it and sharing your insights with all of us via Jihad Watch and other means. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.